English accents with strong Bronx overtones. Dirt. You hear that, you know, that Band-Aid commercial? Dirt. Children have dirt problems. Indeed. Well, of course, you know, I'm in no position to talk. Absolutely none. Nobody has worse English than I have. You know, I'm one of them people who has real bad English. Yes, I got a terrible letter today. It says, Shepard, that Gene Shepard program is an insult to my intelligence. And he spelled intelligence with one L. So I suppose we're all having trouble with advancing creeping meatballism. Of course, the thing you got to remember about the meatball, he doesn't recognize that he is. Never. Meatball, as a matter of fact, thinks he's a prime veal cutlet. And would you please bring it up? Bring the gravy up a little bit there, Nick, old man. Have you noticed lately I've been extremely feisty? Just terrible, I don't know. There is nothing sacred. Nothing. Nothing. No, sir, not the minute, you know, when I found out that two famous television actors who play famous doctors on the screen have got toupees, that ended it. Just terrible. And by the way, there is a rumor out that David Niven is over 700 years old. It's unbelievable. Well, it's a new process. Actually, there's really not just one David Niven. There's six of them. They have nothing sacred here. Excuse me. Of course, I'm in no position to, you know, be snide about people. I really am not. You're listening tonight to a thoroughly chastened human being and who has many embarrassing things to report. I'm probably the only person who'll ever honestly admit it. Very embarrassed about it. You're listening to a person who attended a birthday party for a gerbil. At least I've got the guts to come out and admit it, you know. And what's worse, I took part in it. There's nothing like singing happy birthday, dear Artie. Can you imagine singing happy birthday to a gerbil named Artie? Happy birthday, dear Artie. And this crummy little rat is sitting there, see, in front of a birthday cake made out of sunflower seeds with a candle sticking out of the top of it, and everybody's running around with paper hats on their head. I thought, oh, my God, where is it ever going to end? Where is it ever going to end? I mean, this is the kind of stuff that when they, you know, I was reading in the paper the other day, I don't want to embarrass, you know, the guilty out there, but I sat through this, and not only sat through it, I found myself partaking of it. See, it's bad enough to find yourself involved in some inane farce, but to find that you're standing up on the table singing and dancing and throwing grapes to the Nubian handmaidens, that's the point when you better start blowing the whistles, right? Sickening, I'll tell you. And it's easy, you know, you find yourself getting subverted quickly, very easily, very quickly. Because it's nice guyism. See, first somebody says, hey, wouldn't it be great if we had a birthday party for Artie? And you say, Artie, who Artie? Artie? Artie, are you kidding? That deadbeat, give him a birthday. And then they say, no, Artie the gerbil. So Artie the gerbil? Gerbil? And, first there's a moment of disbelief. And you very quickly begin to adjust to it, and eventually you're having, you know, birthday parties for your favorite cockroach. I know one lady, as a matter of fact, who talks to ants. She seriously believes that, the ants come in and walk all over a sink, and she said, now you stop that. You know that Ed doesn't like that. And they leave. They just pack up and say, okay, and they go. Well, now, the next step, friends, is the loony bin. As a matter of fact, that's a step beyond the loony bin. There's not many people in the loony bin think they can talk to ants. Oh, no. No, that's going a little bit further. You remember when they used to say the loony bin? Great. Now they call it Mental Rehabilitation Center, which I don't think has quite the nice ring to it as the nut house, you know. But we've lost a lot in our, you know, as we get more intellectual, we've lost all kinds of stuff along that line. Oh, yes. But I remember when, you know, very simple, I always, you know, thought if we ever would start to return to the original richness of the language, you know, the original ripe quality of it. You can see a cartoon, this elegant-looking psychiatrist, and he's got a little, you know, a little goatee, and you see in the back he's got the diploma and all that stuff. And he says, well, the trouble is you have a screw loose. Now, I think that, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. It gets right to the heart of it. And it says, you remember when they used to say that? But he has a screw loose somewhere, you know? And it's very true. You like the way I played that accent, huh? Well, you know, I've had a checkered career. I've had to escape hurriedly at 2 o'clock in the morning over many a mysterious border in Middle Europa. And you have to assume many accents. And you always must make sure that your accent sounds like someplace, not where you're at, because they immediately spot that as a phony, but some obscure province to the north. And you just say, well, I'm from Zagreb. And it's, oh, yeah, Zagreb, I have an uncle there. And you get right through real quick. Make sure you move. However, you know, speaking of mysterious times and places of our lives, I have to admit that not only, you know, it's not only bad news here. Everybody's complaining about, you know, inflation and all that stuff. Did you hear what's happening in Tanzania? Oh, the place is in an uproar. Tanzania, you know, you think you go to Tanzania, everything's pretty cool there, you know. Oh, forget it. Tanzania, there's inflation, rising prices, demands for handouts every place. And in Tanzania, there's a big uproar going on. Peter Mwita is leading a movement over there. His name is M.W., you know, I had these great names, M.W.I.T.T.A., Mwita. Peter Mwita is leading a movement there, and he's written to a local paper urging the government to put a ceiling of 15 cows on the price of a chick. Well, you know, you pay for your, you know, you're going to get married over there, you come, you have to lay it out, and it's now 15 cows. It was, you see. He wants to make a ceiling. The going price right now is 40 to 45 cows. And he says, that's rotten, ridiculous, considering the local women. You know, he's really getting bugged. Well, you know, you got to, you know, it's, you pay for what you get, you know. And he says, it is also necessary, Mr. Mwita complained, and we're quoting his letter, to buy a big blanket, raincoat, and cap, military type, for the father-in-law. Military type. I mean, that adds a little pizzazz to it, too. You also must buy a steel saucepan costing 35 shillings for the mother-in-law and to slaughter two fat oxen to welcome relatives. And he says, it's getting out of hand. Ridiculous. No wonder there's a big wave of nobody getting married over there. You know, a lot of guys wearing purple shirts now and wearing those funny little shoes. And you know, in Tanzania, there is a version of Fire Island breaking out as a result of this. Oh, yeah. So, you know, there's a lot of complaining about it over there. And we got to, you know, we have to, it's happening everywhere. I mean, life is not easy. And you figure sometimes, you know, everybody thinks of, you know, tranquility all of a sudden when you get to be a silver-haired old gentleman and you become tranquil. Well, it's not not necessarily so. There's another side. Would you please, if you will, Nick, with a little of that English stuff in there. I'm practicing my English accent.
Rock, me. Maybe shade, but rack, pork. The British Broadcasting Corporation, in connection with Overseas Third Program Services, now presents Salute to the English Spirit Everywhere. The English Empire is no longer, but the English spirit remains. My God, there'll always be an Englishman. And tonight, the Third Program Services of the Overseas Broadcasting System of the British Broadcasting Corporation presents our special feature, Salute to Brave English Peoples Everywhere. And tonight, we salute a brave English woman of London. When burglars invaded the home of Miss Jenny Ireland of London, 98 years old, she said she did not mind a bit. Miss Arnold complained, and in fact, explained that other than a local nurse and a cleaning woman, she rarely had visitors, and that her guests, and we quote they are, the guest's intrusion was welcome. As she lay in bed, the two men crept around the room, stealing $7.20, U.S. money, her pension book, and her door key. I wasn't frightened a bit, Miss Arnold said later of the incident. It did not frighten me. It was most exciting. Life gets boring, and it brightened things up a bit. I didn't speak to the men, but one of them did smile. in typical English polite fashion. And so tonight the Third Broadcasting Service salutes that second burglar, performed with style, precision, and above all in good taste. The British Broadcasting Corporation, in connection and in cooperation with the Third Program Services, has presented our special favor, a salute to the British spirit everywhere. We'll fight them from the hedgerows. We'll fight them from the beaches, and by God, there'll always be an Englishman. Stay tuned for Lady Dame Flora Whittleworth Flukely and her program, Stamp Collecting Annual.
Why do they wish that stuff on me? Why don't they put them special features on, you know, the intellectual shows on the station here, like, you know, Rambling with Gambling, and those groovy shows, you know? Oh, yeah, can you imagine going out one night and doing a little Rambling with Gambling? Wouldn't that be exciting? Well, of course, I'm in a bad mood tonight. You know, anyone who's attended the birthday of a gerbil is in a bad mood. I'm telling you, I felt silly after it was over, you know. Because everybody's, you know, it was kind of embarrassing because I got in my car, you know, everybody's singing happy birthday out on the lawn of this place out there. And, you know, they've got these little, you know, these little favor things that you pull the ends of them. Those little things go, you know, they pop like that. And out comes a hat, you know, Napoleon hat. Says make a wish and all that. And it's kind of silly to do that when there's a gerbil standing around, you know, because the gerbil is a very primitive creature. I'll tell you, that little son of a guy got me in the thumb once. Boy, I'll tell you, you know, they bite very fast. Got me right down to the nub in there. And, you know, I was a little disgusted. You know what you give gerbils for a birthday gift? Well, you give him your thumb to chew on for a couple of seconds. He's been trying to do that for weeks, so I just stuck my thumb in there and says, go ahead, all right, and, you know, zap, after the blood was cleared. You know, I didn't know. I always thought they were vegetarians. Well, I'm not a vegetable friend. This is WOR New York. Well, at least I'm not officially a vegetable. There have been a lot of complaints, you know, about my vegetableism creeping kohlrabiism. Incidentally, I notice with a great deal of sorrow that the great kohlrabi myth persists in spite of the fact that we blew that balloon sky high here a couple of years ago. What's that? You don't know what the kohlrabi myth? I presume you believe there is such a thing as a kohlrabi. You do believe that. Well, of course, you know, there's certain people who persist in playing off and making hay, if I may use an archaic expression, on people's persistent mythology. In fact, I know one guy who is a sort of a pseudoscience writer who's always proving that there is an abominable snowman. And he has pictures that show the shadow of one as it just left, you know, taken by a Sherpa photographer with a bad Instamatic. You see, and underneath it says a little asterisk. It says, unfortunately, most of the film was lost on this expedition. However, and he's been made. He also proved that one time there was a giant bird living on the shore of Jersey that would come out at 2 o'clock in the morning. And he had 8-foot square claws. Did you remember that one? Yeah. Well, he sold stories on that one for a while. And of course, then everybody discovered it was a dentist in Teaneck that was doing it. Hear about that? This dentist would get up every morning at 6, or I think he was a dentist, and he had these fake claws made, and he would strap them to his feet. And he'd run across the beach. And the next thing you know, it's all in all the magazines and all the TV people there, and Gabe Pressman is up to his neck in a swamp trying to interview a mud hen, you know, on the monster of the Jersey Shore. And he was big on that for a while. And then, of course, the flying saucer thing went out. He was very big on flying saucers for a while. But then, of course, that's gone. You know, nobody believes that anymore. I mean, you know. And wait till you see the mail I'll get on that tomorrow. And they're always written, people tend to send me little smudgy magazines that have been done on a mimeograph machine in some guy's basement, you know, called The Sightings of Amalagorda, New Mexico. Mr. and Mrs. Fred Gutstop, the owner of an Esso station there, had a distinct visit with three Venusians. And they sent it to me. And they see, what do you mean? You idiot, you don't believe it. Here it is. They couldn't write it if it weren't true. Ha ha. And oh, yeah, you know, that's called a self-perpetuating myth. So nevertheless, this same guy, I noticed in the most recent magazine now, he is proving that there is a 200-foot-long sea monster living at the bottom of Loch Ness. Now, they almost got a picture of it, always, you see. Oh, my. You know, the trouble with poor old Barnum. You remember Barnum? Yeah, well, you remember what he said, his most famous line? Now, would you please repeat that, Nick? Do you have a talkback system? Would you please touch the button to tell me what he said? Can't hear it. The microphone's on. You mean when you turn on the talkback, you can't hear it? Yeah. What is it that Barnum said? Very good. Very good. You notice we censored that? Of course, that's what Barnum said one night in Springfield, Illinois. And it was a terrible scene. He said it in the lobby of a hotel there. And it was recorded by several local journalists, they called them in those days. Now they're simply called finks. Of course, at one time they used to be called ink-stained wretches. And they recorded this, and Nick Brown in there knows, oh, he's a great student of, course, he would know about this. He's a great student of P.T. Barnum. And if you stick with reading the life of P.T. Barnum, you'll know where it's at, kid. You just stick with it. And he, among other things, one of his more harmless remarks was that there is a sucker born every minute, right? I don't know. Did he use the word sucker? Well, I think that's what he did. He says there's a sucker born every minute. And, of course, unfortunately, like so many comments that were made in the Victorian age, in the 19th century, he did not anticipate the population explosion. Nor did he anticipate either the Johnny Carson show and various other cultural achievements of our time. I would say that if Barnum were alive today, he would have to say at least there's one born every maybe 3 or 4 milliseconds. And sometimes they come in groups. So, you know, you can do pretty good if you stick with it. And I think though, that the problem, of course, of being a sucker. I mean, are you one out there, friend? How about you, Nick? Do you feel that you've been had? No, of course not. You're on top of it. That's true. Have you noticed that they're trying to update Yoo-Hoo now, making it into a big action drink, you know, like vodka or something? But, yeah, it shows all these dynamic-looking types drinking Yoo-Hoo. Did you see that ad? I thought it was kind of a basic... that's folk humor, actually. Of course, this you know, 6 1/2 doesn't have, you walk into a bar, you know, in a place called you know, Dead Jawbone, Colorado, and you say, give me a wild strawberry Yoo-Hoo on the rocks. And, you know, it's not going to work. But nevertheless, tonight, I'm going to take this opportunity tonight to confess that I'm getting irascible. I mean, you notice a streak of irascibility that's beginning to... it's just sickening. I tried to fight against it. I tried to enter that little thing, you know. Incidentally, they were also celebrating at the same time this crummy gerbil had its birthday. They were celebrating its engagement party simultaneously. And the betrothed was in a cage. They had the betrothed a couple of blocks away. They says, you don't put them together because in 5 seconds you got too many gerbils. You're knee-deep in these babies. So, of course, when they the kids also discovered that gerbils tend to devour their young. Yeah, they do, you know, which is so human when you stop to think about it. It's one of the reasons why we love gerbils, because, you know, there's not only gerbils devour their young, there's a lot of other things do, too, in many different ways. 6 1/2 does. But remember this, if you feel, you know, the young are now all applauding this, you see, because they feel innocent about this. No, you're part of the human race, because, see, because the time will come when you will begin to devour something else, you know, and... So each, it's like the fish, you know, the big fish eats the smaller fish, et cetera, down till finally you get down to the bottom, you know, where the tiniest fish of all is just sitting around waiting for the axe to fall. You see, this is called ecology, kid, right? Good. Now, you don't want to louse up the whole ecological chain, do you, by finking out? I mean, you know, it's just like, you know, after all, what is it? You got to face it. The bluebirds live on, angleworms, right? Well, let's just assume that, see? Well, if the angleworms start fighting back, that louses up the bluebirds. Okay. Now, who's lousing up the ecological chain of command there? Is it the bluebirds or the angleworms? What's the angleworms? So the pecking order is important. Pecking order is another phrase that can be used to describe the ecological chain. Right. You okay? How you stand out there in the pecking order, friends? You doing much pecking, or you getting pecked? Which is it? Well, of course, 6 of 1 half dozen. You know, you get one peck, you get two pecks in the back of the head for every one you get in. Right? Well, that's the truth. You know, in the great game of life, there are some people who are bowling pins, others are bowling balls. Which are you? One thing, it's no good being a head pin. I'll tell you. Nobody worries about the 7 pin. It's the head pin they aim the shot at, right? So I would suggest you try to look for a good job as a number 5 pin in the great set of life. But I don't want to, you know, it's one of those, after all, it's July. And I did happen to jig. One thing I like July very much. It's a very rare month. We rarely have the month of July. We have a hell of a lot of Februarys. We have, we're continually, over and over again, we're continually having Novembers. Have you noticed that? And quite a few Januaries. But rarely do we have a July. Some years go by, years and years go by, never a July. And here it is, July, and I'm surprised. And so I dig this. And one thing I like about July, every July, about 500 letters arrive a week from kids who have been sent off to some place called Camp Wahoo Kanucky in New Hampshire, and they're very bugged because they can't hear WOR up there, and they say, please do something about it. Well, I don't know what to do. You know, what are you going to do? Send a St. Bernard dog up there, you know, with a tape recorder on his neck or something? And I'm sorry, kid, if your old man thinks that you better spend your summer in Camp Wahoo Kanucky making leather wallets with pictures of Roy Acuff on them, that's your hang-up, not mine, kid. Believe me, I had my time. I paid my dues, kid. Yes, sir. You're talking to a graduate of Camp Arrowhead. And I'll never forget Camp Arrowhead near Kalamazoo, Michigan. Oh, what an exciting place. I'll tell you. We had the leather craft. And nothing is boring, more boring to me than to sit around in a circle. They called it an Indian circle. You know, you make a, you sit cross-legged. And you start out with the Camp Arrowhead Indian chant and salute of friendship. You know, it's all done in Indian dialect. I don't want to bore you because it was originally Shawnee and has a tendency to sound obscene if you don't understand the language. But, a lot of people misunderand that. And so we sat around, we sang the Camp Arrowhead song. You know, Camp Arrowhead, we love thee. I don't want to sing that either because it's very boring. The second set of lyrics, though, got a little faster because the kids wrote them themselves. And by the time we got to the third set of lyrics, it would be very easy to get busted in Kalamazoo singing them out loud. And we had T-shirts, you know, Camp Arrowhead. And the guys used to tend to change the, you know, they had a big picture of an arrowhead on the outside of it, you know, all in color and all. And guys would tend to make their own comments on their T-shirts, you know, with the marking pens and all that stuff. So I don't know what to say about this. It's July, and I understand that there's nobody listening. I like that, frankly. One thing I like about New York at this time of the year, you know, you can just walk out there. You can fire a shotgun right down the middle of Fifth Avenue and not hit more than, maybe 5,000-6,000 people. And that's good. I mean, it gives you a sense of, you know, you can feeling of expansion, and you can study your fellow man, and cuts down on isolation. You know, how are you doing, by the way, on your case of isolation, friends? How you doing on communication with your fellow human being? That's what I figured. Come see, come saw. Sometimes you just feel you want to hit them in the chops. That's the end of it, you know. Forget the whole damn scene, you know. But that's, you know, you pick it up and you lay it down. Of course, one of the reasons why I'm particularly, I suppose you can say, irascible tonight, I don't know. How many of you got the same hang-up? I have a bad hang-up of our times. Bad is a... You know, you're doing something, see, like you're writing the third chapter of War and Peace, and you're working away at it. Yeah, I mean, don't laugh. I mean, Dostoevsky sat down, and he says, now what am I going to have him do? Let's see. You know, I'm getting so tired of these two brothers walking, or Karamazov. That's a bad name in the beginning. It's not a commercial name. And no. And Tolstoy, Dostoevsky, all those guys must have had the same problem. You know, Melville sitting down, he says, oh, now let's see, Call me Ishmael. That's a bad... It's kind of a biblical thing. It, you know, the Bible belt, they're going to get bugged. I'm using it. And I can imagine, his editor, Doubleday, calling him up. Says, look, Ishmael's just a little bit, that's a little bit archaic name. Can't you say, call me Greg? Start with a, you know, some a name that sings. It's got to have some singing swing to it. And this Captain Ahab, what's his first name? Is that his first name? What is this? Fred Ahab, is that it? What is it? Ebenezer Ahab? And this business of white whale. People are no longer interested in fishing. No, that's an old-fashioned idea. But, of course, then again, on the other hand, you know, it's easy to get irascible because have you got the habit of turning on the TV set and letting the darn thing just jabber? And you know, you just sit there and the light flickers and you can see it, you see the shadows of the screen playing on the wall. And then once in a while, you catch a fleeting image of Joan Crawford's derriere outlined in shadow as it goes whistling across your 8th Street bookstore prints and your gigantic blow-up picture of Paul Newman in drag. So, you know, well, yeah, this is all part of the village scene. So, George, but our time, it's going to be hard to explain to posterity, isn't it? So, can you imagine some poor guy getting caught with 26 million impeach Johnson that fink buttons? I mean, what's he doing with them, you know? Where are they today? Where are all those old Johnson posters today? You remember all those old Hubert Humphrey posters? What are people doing with them? I've often wondered about poster buyers, you know? I mean, to kind of buy the pop poster, you know, the picture of a current idol. And what, you know, where are they today, you know? All the Herb Alpert posters, you remember that? Herb Alpert. That's like having, an autographed picture of Lawrence Welk standing behind his accordion, you know, with the sequins on the front of it. But 6 of 1, half a dozen of the other. In fact, that would be a totally camp thing to have, now that I think about it. You know? It says, to Normie, you know, Larry. And underneath it, yeah, it says, in remembrance of that fantastic pot party that night, signed Larry. And, you know, you have that hanging in your pad. You know, there's Lawrence standing there, you know, a one, a two, and he's got his big old accordion going there. And I think this would really be camp. Really, I'd like to have an autographed picture of Ed McMahon, you know, holding up a can of dog food, you know, with that that funny look on his face. He gets a vaguely embarrassed look. Can you imagine a tremendous panel of all the great opinion molders of our time? You know, the really dynamic, powerful people of our time. Ed McMahon, Hugh Downs, you know, Jack LaSchooley. I mean, these are all true folk heroes. And have the thing emceed by Mike Douglas. And they're, you know, talking about life and times. Have you noticed these guys tend to get very vaguely philosophical? They're always writing a book called My Family's Favorite Poetry by Hugh Downs. And it starts out, it takes a heap of living to make a house a home. And, can you imagine? I think what a great camp thing would be to a collection of poems, you know. Hugh Downs collects his favorite between the bookends as the fireplace crackles on the quiet winter night's poetry for moments of reverie. And you open it up, and it says, I saw my generation, and splat, and 5,000 obscene words. I'm sorry. I'm, you know, a bad man here. But that, nevertheless, I'm sitting there. Why I'm talking like this tonight, I'm sitting there saying I'm working on this short story. So I've been working on when you get involved in the story sometimes, it's just like growing a giant wart on your head. It's just terrible. By the way, I'm amazed at my naivete of people. I must report some of it to you. I got a letter today from a woman. Says, Dear Mr. Shepherd, my husband, Charles, and I find your program somewhat amusing at times, particularly when you tell us those wonderful stories about your trips around the world. But what I'm really writing you about, I just became aware recently that you occasionally write a short story in Playboy magazine. I'm interested in having them print a short story of mine, but I wish to be protected because I'm sure that they will steal many of my fine ideas And I'm sending you along this short story, and you tell them to print it, and when they print it, to get in touch with me, and we will arrange the financial details. Oh, my God. I don't know. I wonder whether people know that Playboy happens to be one of the most difficult markets in the world for a writer to crack. Are they aware of that? Are you two in there aware of that? You are? Well, are you? I don't think he is. He's standing there dumbly. He still thinks the Christian Herald is a tough one to make. I wonder how many people are aware of that. I don't know. I think that what they think is you write the story and you send it in and they print it. And you know, this is the kind of thing. Oh, did I tell you the funny thing that happened to me the other night? I'll tell you. I hope that Bill Doc is listening. Now, the other night, I was involved. A friend of mine was in this little theater thing. You see, they're doing this little theater production out in Jersey. See, so I attempt to go to these things, in mufti. I mean, if Shepard is ever trapped in Jersey, you know, no telling where the scandal would end. You know, so I went over there. Of course, I was wearing my disguise. I have this big Edwardian mustache that I wear, and I have these pair of light golden, beautiful, they're from the actual golden retriever hair, this magnificent pair of removable sideburns. I've got a great, they fit on a strap around the neck and all. So I went over there and I was wearing my bell-bottom things and I had on my black shades, you know, these quartz lens glasses that are strictly Dickensian. I mean, the kind that the old Mr. Copperfield would have worn, you know, in his declining years. Ebenezer Scrooge-type glasses, little round ones with dark blue lenses, you know. And I had a knobbled walking cane, see, which I took over there. And I kept saying things like, I don't know. And so this woman came up to me. I was spotted in the lobby, see. And she was all excited. She says, gee, you're Gene Shepard? I said, yes. And she says, well, you know, I listen to your program so much. She says, my whole family, we listen to your program. We've listened to your program for a long time. Listen to this, Nick. And she says, oh, we laugh so much at you. We came to see you at Town Hall. Say, you know, you ought to be an entertainer. Well, I don't know what the hell she thinks I am, but that isn't all. This Dill Doc even topped herself, which was not easy to do at that point, see. She says, and by the way, she says, another thing, I've read all of your stories, all those stories you've printed at Playboy, and I've read your novel. You know, you should be an author. Dump, dump, dump. So, you know, you get a little irascible about this, see? You do, ultimately. And I'm sure that I can just see, can't you just see Nijinsky returning home, say, one day on a weekend, after a, you know, very tough week at the ballet with Diaghilev and all those guys, you know, and he arrives back home in his hometown in Russia, and somebody says, Nijinsky, and he says, yes, you know you dance a good. You should learn tap dance. Very good. You'll be on vaudeville. What the devil? You know, and it always works that way, you know. In fact, I went to Phil Rizzuto one time, said somebody came up to him and says, you know, you can really play, you can really, have you ever thought of being an athlete instead of a ball player? And so, you know, where do you go? Oh, yes, people are like that, and they come right up and say these things. So, you just realize ultimately that all the world's a Dill Doc and you're just one of them, you know, just play it along for what it's worth. And so one day, just this past weekend, I'll just tell you why I'm so irascible tonight. I'm sitting there, seeing, I'm working away at this short story I'm working on, see, for Playboy, and I'm working away, and it's a very, you know, irritating thing, so I'm thinking and walking around and bugged, and the TV set's going, TV set is kind of like a security blank for a lot of people, see. There's something sad about a dead TV set, something infinitely sad about a TV set that's turned off, you know, so much like you've turned off life. And it sits over there in the corner. And, of course, there's another thing, too. Certain types of TV set tend to look hurt when they're turned off. And they tend to look reproachfully at you. So this TV set sitting over there. And have you noticed how much dust the front of your TV set gathers? Well, you know why this is so, don't you, friend? Especially if you have a color set. Been aware of that? What's this due to static, magnetic static attraction? It's that's related to Brownian movements. It is. Well, of course, you know, I hate to trot out my superior knowledge from time to time here, but there's a time when you just have to do that. You got to let the class know that you're a couple of jumps ahead of them. How long has it been since you've observed the trackings of a Brownian movement? You know, what is it, a Brownian movement? You do. Now, look, it has nothing to do with a gentle laxative. I'm talking about something else. Do you know anything about this? Now, come on. What is it? What is it? When you look at dust in the air, friend, you know, do you ever sit there with your jaw hanging slack, with your eyes glazing over, and you're in a classroom or something, and you can't keep your eyes open? It's like going to a really dull sales meeting. You know, and this guy's going, blah, 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 and they're going on, and your mind is totally out to lunch. Your mind is not on anything else. Your mind is turned off for the day. It's not on anything. And you're sitting there with your eyes glazing, and you look up, and you see millions of tiny pieces of dust floating down through that shaft of sunlight. And strangely enough, then you notice that the dust is not moving in what seems to be logical sequence. It goes, shoots off and bounces around. It just goes up and down. And you tend to think this is due to stray currents. It is not. Okay? All right. We'll let that wait for next semester when you'll be more prepared for it then. We don't want to hurry your training here. But I'm sitting there, and the TV set is going on, and now here comes the point of the whole show. You ready for it? Connects to that old lady in her room getting 98 years old and the whole thing, digging this burglars coming in and a crummy gerbil. I think a little raucous kazoo music, please, if you will, please. We just need this to clear the atmosphere. I'm attempting to do something about my irascibility. Mind if I play this thing a little bit, Nick? You think your father would mind? You don't, huh? Thank you. Thank you. Well, I don't really play that. You know, that's all on tape. I don't play any of that. It's all a fake. Everything's a fake, absolutely. Total fake. Now, you don't think that Mike Nichols directs those movies he directs, do you? Oh, come on. Come on. Kazan works for him, you know, under another name. But that's another story. But nevertheless, I'm sitting there, and the TV set is going on, blabbing away. And here, and once in a while, you know, you don't even know what picture's on. It's late movie time, you know, just before the God Squad takes over. You're paying no attention whatsoever. Once in a while, you know, the lady plumber shows up briefly and disappears into the darkness. And occasionally that guy that's selling used cars up in the Bronx comes on and tells you they're having another big auction of clunkers with bad camshafts, you know. And you watch that all this stuff drifts past. And the picture started against it, black and white, fuzzy picture. And I vaguely sensed that David Niven was there. See, he was there. This is David Niven at the age of 3 or something, making a movie. See, so he's in the darkness there. And they're driving along a road. Now, I wonder how many million pictures have you seen. Almost every movie at one point had two people in a car. It was a mandatory scene of two people driving in a car, this guy driving a car with this chick next to him. Isn't that true, Nick? And it's always for some reason, it's always a convertible, I suppose, because they can, you know, they have the camera, yeah, and it's a convertible. See, so here they're driving along, and I'm paying no attention. It's a usual scene, and I'm working away at this thing here, and all of a sudden, I hear a familiar sound. I look over at the TV set, but a totally, you know, off-the-wall familiar sound, not the kind of familiar sound you expect to hear, you know, like the cockroaches having an orgy in the sink or something, which you expect to hear, you know. I hear this, there's a sound, see, And David Niven is saying to this girl, he says, oh, well, he said, I don't know what's wrong with it. Blasted thing, it has gas, you know, and the car has, you know, fizzled out on him. It stopped. I look up. I said, well, you idiot, I know what's wrong with that car. These two are driving in a car that was exactly like the first automobile I ever had when I was 15 years old. And that car on the screen did the same thing that my rotten car always did. Its fuel pump went out. Well, so the upshot of the scene was the girl thought, you know, he was putting her on, see? He figured, you know, she figured that what he did, he you know, cut the car like that so he could, you know, make the scene with this beautiful girl out there, you know. And, you know, and she looked a little bit like my Aunt Clara, you know. You just can't imagine that happening. But nevertheless, that was the... And so the next scene, they're hitchhiking now. They've left their car, you know, to say... They did that a lot in movies. You know, so they never came back for their car. You wonder what, you know, what happened to their car. And they never seem to be worried about it. They just sort of hitchhike off and leave it there, see. Well, nevertheless, I'm looking at this guy's, oh, no, fuel pump trouble. You are listening to the single human being who at one time held the Middle States freestyle fuel pump diaphragm changing championship for the V8 Ford type diaphragm fuel pump. Unbelievable speed. Do you know, Nick, that I could change a fuel pump while a light was changing? Yes, I have done it. As a matter of fact, this car I had used to pop a fuel pump on an average of every, 17 to 30 minutes, roughly. Well, I got so mad that I used to buy fuel pumps at the Sears Roebuck Automobile Part Department, see? I used to buy fuel pumps, you know, the kit, the rebuilding kit you get for a fuel pump. I used to buy them by the dozen lots. And I'd carry them with me, see, you know, like other guys carry spare dollars and, you know, things around. I would carry fuel pumps with me. And the instant my car, it makes it, I'll tell you what it does. The minute your fuel pump starts to go, it coughs twice. The car loses a little power, and there's a burbling sound, which comes from a ruptured diaphragm of the fuel pump. And then it poops out completely, and there's nothing you can do to start it. Well, I remember one time, guys get to be, have you ever admired people who really change a tire good? Really do it, see. You're talking to a great tire changer. I one time changed a tire in the winter wilds of Toronto on a Peugeot on a superhighway in less than 12 minutes on an unfamiliar car. All right. Well, the scene with the fuel pump, I'll never forget the time. It's, you know, little moments of personal victory. You ever seen a group of drivers applaud another driver for something that happens? Well, my car pooped out. I'm first in line, and the light, see, it stopped. I jumped out of the car, and I'm with this date. See, I want to impress her. I jump out of the car, and while the car, you know, the car is red hot, open the hood. It's still red. I whip off the fuel pump, put in a diaphragm, put in the strainer, put the bolts back on, strap it in. I'm in the car, and by the time it turns yellow, I've turned the key on. It starts, and it was a roar of applause. Every driver saw that Shepard, this driver, this guy in this V8 up here, had changed his fuel pump in the time it took a red light to change to yellow and go to green. That's strictly Indianapolis pit stop class, friends. That's the way they did it with Mario Andretti last year, and the way they did it with A.J. Foyt this year, the way Al Unser does it and Bobby Unser. Shepard's right with him. It's good to be a man who knows how to work with his hands. And fix a fuel pump, hit somebody in the mouth, do the stuff that the hand was made to do. Big it up, big that, big. And that concludes tonight's salute to Fyodor Dostoevsky, one of the great natural realists of the past 200 years in literature. Stay tuned for another public service broadcast, which will be heard next week at this same time by the deep thinking programming portion of our vast broadcasting empire.